All right, so this year, as you know from Tory's talks, we're exploring the ox herding pictures. And these pictures, for those of you who have been around a while, remember from Rodney doing these about, I don't know, 10 years ago or so over at Bodell Hall. And it was I found a very wonderful exploration for that year. And this month of January, we're kind of doing an overview of the pictures as a whole. And then we'll go through each picture month by month, and then in January or in December, do kind of a review and see how we relate to them after exploring them in detail. And I'm happy to have a chance to talk about these as a big picture because it helps me frame it and also helps me get on board with where you've been. So I'll echo some of what Tori said. There'd be some overlap. There'd also be some things which are probably a new perspective, and that's just helps us all broaden our understanding of this topic of these ox herding pictures. So these 10 ox herding pictures, hopefully you have some copy of them or some reference you can use, and I think we're working on getting those online for a web page. That'd be helpful just to reflect on the images themselves and also the various verses that help kind of bring them to life. And it's really a metaphor for the spiritual journey. So it's a metaphor for our, the whole journey, but also the journey in small pieces, even like in the midst of this last meditation. You may have noticed, as you get more experience with these pictures, you can see, okay, I was really kind of in that searching for the ox. I was trying to find where my breath was. Or maybe I was trying to struggle with a hindrance, that sense of trying to tame the ox. Or perhaps there was a quality of steadiness, that quality of mastery of riding the ox home. You start to recognize those as they arise. And these metaphors, as a good metaphor does, carries quite a lot of information, quite a lot of lessons and teaching in a very compact format. And so I want to cover some of the points that come to mind as I was reflecting on these ox herding pictures. Now, as we go through, both tonight and also the whole year, I really encourage you to bring extra awareness to your comparing mind. The mind that compares, okay, where am I? What page, what picture am I on now? And am I where I should be after so many years of practice? Just start to notice that. Notice how am I doing compared to so and so? To notice that tendency to compare and pause with it, to not engage with it. Because it's really not so helpful to get caught up in that, because that just leads to more and more constriction, more and more internal conflict as you judge yourselves, and of course it ties into our habitual judging mind of ourselves. Use it as a teaching. It's okay, here I am in this, it seems like I'm right here in this image, this picture right now in my practice. What can I learn from that? Can I meet that in a wholehearted way without any expectation of where you should go or think you should be? Just meet you yourself where you are. So as we look at these ox herding pictures, the first thing that comes to mind, at least my mind, is, well, what is the ox? What does the ox represent? What is this ox that this person is trying to herd and work with and eventually forget and transcend? And as a good metaphor, we can have different interpretations, different understandings as we go along. So tonight, what comes to mind around these this what the ox is it represents this unification of our mind directed toward liberation. Okay, so the unification of our mind directed toward liberation. So this is encompassing, again, we're talking about ox, not the whole journey, but the ox itself is this kind of unruly mind that we have, and how we can learn to tame it, how we can learn to train it so it can have a quality of deeper seeing, of clear seeing, and a steadiness of seeing. So part of it is, concentration, this firmness of mind, this willingness to stay with this moment's experience. and the way we have so many distractions in our minds, and we learn to release those. So we start to, over time, cultivate that steadiness. But it's not just steadiness of its own sake. It's steadiness that penetrates, it sees more clearly, particularly starting to see and understand life in a more direct, immediate way. Understanding what causes dukkha and what causes the release of that dukkha. And the ox is very interesting because it's vitally important in, I have the pictures here next to me, in six of the pictures, it's like prominent in this. And then it disappears. Then it disappears. And this in itself is a profound lesson around our spiritual practice and how we often take something so important, like our early trainings and the technique itself, and we give ourselves wholeheartedly to that technique. And there's a sense of mastery that comes from that. But at some point, we have to be able and willing to release that, really the identification around that. So we'll get more into that here as we explore. Now, these 10 pictures, I was looking at them and kind of dividing them up into four sections. Okay, the first section is that of struggle. Okay, our struggle with our own minds, struggle with our meditation techniques. The next one is the mastery level. We start to develop this competency that we can practice well. And the third section is that of letting go of our mastery, letting go of our identification around that, transcending that. And the fourth section is that of unity, of releasing separation, of releasing duality, and returning into a quality of unification, of integration. So let's take these four sections and kind of dive into them a little bit more. It's the first one of struggle. So this is the very first picture, is like searching for the ox. And this is really the dukkha of life. You know, what is the solution to that dukkha? And so often for us to I remember Rodney talking about this, it made an impression that it's that first calling the ox, you have a sense there's some other way of living life, some other way of meeting life, other than my normal habitual struggle, my normal habitual striving and fighting and resistance, that there must be something else. This is what brought the Buddha to his path, that he realized that, wow, my life is, even though it's going very well, I can see that there's going to be dukkha, there's going to be old age, sickness, and death. And that will come up to a certain level of listening for that ox, that willingness to listen, to start to search for that ox. So this is the beginning of the spiritual journey. You know, sometimes we have a clearer sense of where that journey leads, and sometimes it's more of a vagueness. And that's what I love about these early pictures. There's kind of this vagueness, like you're searching, and you're not sure what you're exactly looking for. You're not sure where to find it. And it starts to clarify. Just like when, and going back to how we can see this in the midst of a meditation period itself, like the 40 minutes we just did, perhaps at first you were just a little confused about, you know, where is that breath? This, you know, this thought seems so alluring, so engrossing, and learning to find your connection to that breath, to the body sensation. And the beginning of this spiritual journey, at least the way I'm going to frame it tonight, it's really not based on faith. It's really based on practice. It's based on seeing for yourself, seeing directly through your own experience. Meditation as a technique, we can frame it in one way as simply giving you the skills to see clearly, to see clearly. And in that clear seeing, then the spiritual practice starts to unfold. So it's not based on believing something else, someone else, some other authority. But it's based on what you see directly in your life, directly in the nitty-gritty of your life, directly in the daily dharmas that we explored last year. And so this beginning part, this struggling and realizing there must be some other way to meet life, we start to turn toward our spiritual practice. we start to learn practices like insight meditation, mindfulness meditation, and start to get a sense of those fundamentals, the ABCs of how do I breathe? How do I meet? How do I work with the hindrances? We start to learn how to work with our minds, to study our minds, how to cultivate a non-judgmental awareness. This is starting to see the traces of the ox, seeing the tracks of the ox. And it's starting to become clear. Oh yeah, this way of practicing seems to be fruitful. This seems to be helpful. We start to become more clear which kinds of practices or relationships to our practice or attitudes are not so helpful. We start to glimpse the ox. And so this early part of this section I'm calling struggle, we start to go then beyond mindfulness as a technique in itself. We start to actually see, you know, why are we practicing? We're practicing not to have so much a calmer mind, but really to liberate our hearts. The calm mind is a side effect. And this is, I think, an important point to make this day and age with applied mindfulness or secular mindfulness having such a strong foothold, you know, for and a very beneficial foothold in our society, but realizing it often lacks this deeper understanding of why we're practicing. These ox herding pictures brings that perspective to the forefront. It brings our perspective to our forefront. Otherwise, there only be six pictures. So we start to practice understanding the Four Noble Truths, you know, really what's this wise intention, this wise view. Then this point, we're starting to work with the ox directly. We're starting to work with how do we unify our mind in order to liberate our hearts. We start to become more and more skillful. You know, there's a certain, a lot of pushing and pulling and struggle because ox is a powerful beast. You know, all of us know how powerful the mind can be, how powerful the hindrances can be, you know, how hard it is to find some place of grounding, some place of centeredness, some place of wisdom in the midst of a struggle in our lives. Like many of the struggles that we talked about this last year in the daily dharmas. And we're starting to meet our deeper conditioning, our deeper unconscious beliefs, unconscious, you know, foundations of creating dukkha. And eventually we start to tame the whole thing. We start to realize that it's not so much our effort, but more the release of that effort. And this is where with Zen, these are Zen pictures, and there's such a paradox between effort and non-effort within Zen, and really within our own practice or tradition itself, is that we often need to use effort at first. And then eventually we start to realize that the effort itself gets in its way. But if we hadn't applied the effort in the first place, we would never get to that place. And these pictures, you know, portray this in such a clear way that the effort is needed at some point. Without that effort, there wouldn't be any depth of practice. And at some point, that depth we have to release that. We have to release that effort, I should say, because that depth starts to demand it. So then we move from this first section as I'm kind of breaking out from this struggle, from trying to find where the ox is and where am I going to find my way through from my dukkha to trying to find a quality of ease, quite a peace in my life. We start to move into the mastery section. You start to master the technique of meditation. Now, sometimes in this day and age, again, we skip this part because back when the Buddha was teaching, and for most of the history of Buddhism, it was hard to find someone to study with. It was hard to find a teacher who was willing to teach you and you had access to. And so when you found that teacher, you were able to just to devote yourself to their way of teaching, their way of unfolding the practice, and that itself provided this pathway of opening. Because each technique, each tradition, each sub-tradition has its own logic, its own methodology, and it has a purpose to that. Now, this day and age, I mean, we could jump on the internet and find, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of meditation instructions. And sometimes they, they're emphasizing this way or that way, and it gets a bit confusing. We get a bit eclectic in our practice. Even the three major traditions of Theravadin, of Zen, and Tibetan Buddhism, they all have their own way of unfolding the practice. And so sometimes as Westerners, we kind of go to the buffet and we fill up our plate with all kinds of food, and we get a little confused about how we should practice. And so just this is also an important point, though, is that learning how to deepen our practice often means we need to focus in on one particular way for a while, one particular voice, and not to get too confused. Once we get enough stability in our own understanding, then we can see, okay, the different ways of expressing the Dharma are all pointing toward the same thing. They're all pointing to the same source, the same insight. But from a distance, from our place of not so much experience, it can be confusing because they seem to be contradictory to each other. So we need enough depth of seeing, in order to transform our seeing. So at this mastery level, you're gonna this is the taming the ox and riding the ox home, those two pictures in particular. We start to have this confidence to meet the moment, start to be able to meet this mind state, this hindrance, with the depth of confidence. We have less doubt in our own practice. We start to know our own minds more and more, and its habitual ways of contraction, habitual ways of causing suffering. And we learn skillful means. We go on retreats. We have, longer years of practice under our belt. We start to feel confident as a meditator. Maybe here's where we want to start to tell people about, look, let me tell you how to meditate. So there's a level of mastery as we start to ride the ox home. Now, this is, I think, a very important point of these whole pictures, is that, again, it's not six pictures, it's 10 pictures. So sometimes we kind of get stagnant. We kind of stop right here at this sixth picture, the picture of riding the ox home, the picture of mastery. Because it feels really good. It's like, wow, I feel calm. I feel collected. I can meet this experience. I can meet this experience. But these pictures remind us of what the overall aim of the practice is. Because sometimes we forget that overall aim of liberation because we get so enamored with that mastery. So I think we're fine as we go through these 10 pictures that it speaks to all of us, those who are just beginning on the path or people who have been practicing for many years, because it speaks to where we might get stuck, where we might get stagnant. So this mastery piece, this is where the pictures kind of take a kind of a surprising turn. Because I think from a Western, I don't know if it's necessarily just a Western mind state, but we think, okay, we've mastered it. Now let's just kind of make a field with the ox and learn how to do the ox do tricks and maybe get more ox. And soon we have a whole herd of well-trained oxes, is perhaps how our minds might go. But the next picture, number seven, is forgetting the ox. Is forgetting the ox. And that's a bit of a shock. It's a bit of a surprise. And it's really an important transition and lesson about the spiritual practice. And not to stay stuck in the mastery level, not to stay fixated in that, not to stay identified in that level. Because this one picture, this one transition starts to show what our true intention behind our practice really is, what our true intention is. Because if we want to really stay in that level of mastery, of competency, of, I'm a good meditator, our view is around selfing, is around the self of as a meditator, that is where we've stopped, that's where we've landed, that's where we identify. The self of the expert meditator, the competent meditator. And so the ox herding pictures become confusing from that perspective if we stay stuck in that, if we're really identified in that. often consciously, that I want to stay a competent, skillful meditator, a masterful meditator. And yet, and if that's what the ox is finally getting the ox under control and it's tame and I can have complete harmony with it, to let go of the ox confronts something else. It points to, well, really, why are we practicing? Are we practicing to become really good meditators or to liberate our hearts? Are we practicing to become better meditators or to liberate our hearts? So this is the identification with the mastery. In the Theravadin suttas and in the Buddha's early words, he uses this analogy of a raft, that our practice is this raft you use to go across the floods, across this, you know, this river that's storming, going across the level of dukkha. This is the first six page or first pictures is going through our dukkha, learning to find that ground. But the Buddha said, once you get to the other shore, you don't want to keep carrying that raft around. And yet so often we do, we stay identified and we're carrying that raft around as we're trying to continue on the journey. So both the Buddha's, the sutta and these pictures point to the release of that raft, the release of our identification with that mastery, forgetting the ox, forgetting the ox. And this starts to bring in that, you know, in our practice, we get to this point where we start to realize it's so much of it is around understanding the sense of me, the sense of self, this identification around me and others, the separation that I perceive as I look out. In fact, we can frame this whole series of pictures as this engagement of self through these stages, through these stages. So that first, we're going to take a quick little detour as we explore that piece there. That first few stages, you know, I'm confused. I'm not sure where freedom is. I'm not sure where liberation is. I'm looking this way and that way. I'm searching for the ox. I'm trying to sense where the ox is. There's the suffering self, the self who is searching, the search, the self who is confused. The self who is struggling with the ox, who's trying to learn to meditate, learning how to meet the hindrance, how do I meet when my mind is full of aversion or restlessness and worry? There's a self that's with that. When we start to move to that next level of the mastery, as I'm, you know, laying out these 10 pictures, then we start to be the self of the meditator who is the master of the technique. And this is, again, a very seductive stage because it feels good. You feel competent. I mean, everybody wants to feel competent in what they do. And yet this is not where it ends. And there's so many, you know, if you're reading these Zen stories, you know, especially Zen in the Ways, when people are practicing different art forms, there's this often this level of as a beginner, you just don't know what you're doing. And then eventually you start to attain this level of mastery. At some point, there's a release of that. There's a release of that identification. I think I have time for a quick story from the Zen and the Ways. Yeah. So this is a story that, if I recall, I think it was set in China, that there was a guild of musicians, of very talented musicians, and they had gathered together, and they invited someone from a different country to come and play a flute that's never been heard in that region before. And as the master played it, at the end, there's complete silence. Everyone was so just transcended into their listening. There's a silence just came through them until one person finally said the ultimate compliment, like a god. This was playing like a god. So this group of musicians decided to get one of their most talented people to go study with this master. So they scraped together money to, so they could, that person could support himself while he was studying. So he starts to go and study with the master, and he had a technical piece. He worked on it, and fairly soon he felt he had mastered it. But the master always said, "Something missing, something missing." So he redoubled his efforts. He could play it backwards and forwards, and still something missing. After months and months of this, finally the young man, slunk away in the night, ashamed that he cannot get the endorsement that he had finally mastered this new flute. And he went off and started to live in poverty because he was too ashamed to go back to his village, to all the other fellow musicians who had shared their money. Until finally, he started to play, do lessons for kids. And finally, that group of musicians, original ones, found him and invited him back after many years. As he came back, he was invited to play, and he was surprised that he had brought that flute, the original flute, that he had never quite mastered. And he was in rags. He had really let go of his ego to such a depth. And he found himself playing that flute without any investment, without any concern about being judged or not, transcending it. And at the end, it's complete silence. And someone said, "Like a god." So this is often the way the practice is conveyed, is this point of struggle, of mastery. And then at some point we have to release something very deeply within us. We have to release that very perspective of separation of self and other. And this is where the practice points toward. And the ox herding pictures again display this in a very, very powerful way. There's the transcending the ox, transcending whip and the rod, starting to forget the self. You start to become less, you become disoriented. It's such a strange part of our practice that it's something that we've so much invested in, the idea of being a meditator or being able to meditate well. And we start to release that in itself because it has actually worked perfectly. It's something that's coming through us that we did not expect. And then going, transcending the ox, returning to the source. This is the next phases of these 10 steps. And the final picture is that of returning to the village, entering the marketplace, but entering it not with our normal assumptions, our normal identification, but returning liberated with a freed heart. And the way that life is transformed through that, the path we have taken. And this is the integration of our lives, is learning how to come back into those things like the daily dharma, into relationships, into death and dying, into whatever it is that we meet it from our wisdom. So these 10 ox herding pictures, they're portrayed as a linear process or linear progression. And again, watching your tendency to compare, to judge, to try to see where you are, where you think you should be. Not to stop that process, but to actually observe it. Observe the fact that you want to fix where you are and see that as a point of practice in itself. See that in itself as a point of practice. Because sometimes we can have a deep opening, we have a deep insight, we have this taste of some of these later pictures, and then, that seems to dissipate, and we want to struggle to get back there. And so we find ourselves back with trying to find where that ox was in the first place. And we're trying to search for it, and we're trying to, pull it out of the brambles and find, and we kind of get those, again, one of those little loops we get caught in. That sometimes a deep insight becomes a place of deep dukkha as we try to get back to that insight. And so learning, through trial and error, we often learn through the pathway is through release, is through non-identification investment. And learning how to integrate these things into our life. Jumping to that very last picture. Okay, how can I meet this argument with my loved one from a place of wisdom? How can I meet this difficulty with a quality of compassion? these 10 pictures. I'm really looking forward to this year because they point to something which is around effort. Wise effort, right effort, and the deeper and deeper releasing of effort. There's tremendous effort at the beginning when we're going through this blind search or we're not even sure which way to go. There's the effort of struggling with our technique, trying to figure out how to breathe without controlling my breath. How do I, come back from my mind that just wants to think and think and think? And there's the effort of releasing our effort. Of starting to let that effort, letting the practice just run itself, letting the meditation do itself. There's the effort of transcending that, of releasing that identification, which is effort is even a hard word for that. It's because it almost releases from us. Till finally there's the none, there's no self to have the effort. So there's so many lenses we can explore as we go through this year around these 10 pictures. And again, we can see them as the overall path of our lives, of our practice, but also start to notice just in the meditation period that maybe you may find that my mind's so tired and distracted, I'm just kind of focusing on trying to find the ox, trying to see the ox. Or maybe I can really dig down into the technique to find that stability, learning to tame that ox. In times, maybe in the practice period, you start to suddenly find that place of non-effort, that the breath is just perceived, the breath is just known, and there's nothing that needs to be done with it. Even that sense of releasing of self, a releasing of unification, of separation, unification starts to arise. So this year, the 10 ox herding pictures. So both Tori and I are very excited to speak about them and to hear your own exploration around them. Right. So I think that's all I wanted to say right now. So let's just take a couple moments to be still, let those words settle. So in a moment or two, we'll open to any questions or comments you might have. And I'm just going to suggest some homework for this week. I didn't have a chance to actually write it out, but what I would encourage you to do is just reflect on this practice as a whole, and particularly these four elements that I mentioned of our struggle of learning how to find a way through dukkha and how to find our way through our techniques. That mastery of the techniques. And then the release of that mastery, the release of our identification, and then relaxing into the stillness, relaxing into non-separation, and start to reflect on how the practice unfolds for you, and where you might be a little stuck on, if there's any places that you might be stuck. Perhaps you're really focused on the liberation at the end, and that's all you want. But not taking the time to work on the mastery part. Or maybe the technique feels really solid and you don't want to let go of that, just to notice that. Or maybe you're just trying to find where that ox is, and as there's a confusion and difficulty with that, to notice again where your mind lands, where you say, okay, this is where I am in terms of the identification. All right, so we have some chance now for any questions or comments you have. So you're welcome to raise your hand yourself. That's fine. Complete clarity. That's wonderful. All right, Ed, go ahead.
Yeah, this is really just kind of sinking in and kind of soaking into this, that the you guys don't have my picture up. Do I? Yeah, there we go. Yeah, okay.
There you are.
Yeah, it This is, it seems to me this is something where we're not always necessary. There's kind of a certain aspect where it's linear. We kind of tend to go moving along, you know, but there are times when it seems like we're back here again, and then we're back there again, and then we're up here again. And I think it's, it mixes, it gets, it's not that we're, it's not necessarily a straight linear lockstep path. You know, I guess what I'm saying is kind of reminiscent of the stages of death and dying, of coming to grips with death and dying. It's not just a linear path. It's, you know, you get angry and you're okay, and you get angry again and so on. Just an observation, but maybe I'd really ask how you react to that comment.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate way of looking at it, that it's not a linear process. And, you know, and just like so many things which are like at the end of our lives, you know, facing our own mortality or the mortality of loved ones, we often go through those phases of denial and anger and negotiation and sadness and acceptance, and it just kind of cycles and cycles. And I think as our practice, it's like we have one way to frame it from an insight perspective is that we have insights arise through, you know, our sincere seeing, our willingness to practice consistently, they arise. And so that kind of runs us through some of those deeper insights, run us through these pictures very quickly. But then there's integration of those, is how do we actually practice, you know, okay, I see this sense of non-separation, but I feel really separate when I'm arguing with my wife. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, it's so gripping there. And so it's that kind of that integration, that learning how to see through that. And then we go back into those earlier stages of trying to find the ox. But each one of those insights, we start to recognize the ox more clearly. We start to be able to find that more clearly because they start to have this cumulative effect. And at some point, there's enough of those insights, so there's a depth of some of them, that there's some things just fall away in our lives. And the other ones become, okay, this is the thing that now needs to be worked on and to be met. Because we are, you know, we are multifaceted people. We're complex people. We have, you know, conditioning from our childhood, from our relationships, from our life's experiences, from our culture, our society. So all these, you know, need to be worked with, need to be met. And so then there's, I think that's a good way to frame it. That is, it's not a linear process. And sometimes I think that an easy trap, I try to emphasize this, is not to judge where we are, we think we are. Because sometimes if we feel like I've been practicing for decades and I seem to be right back at that first stage, that actually may be a very wise place to be. It may be, because we're kind of working always with our delusion. It's like there's this level of delusion, of unclarity, of confusion, that's just right on the leading edge if our practice is really working that leading edge. And sometimes we fall into the delusion and we become completely muddled and confused. But if we can persevere, then that starts to dissipate. And then we look around our life, look around our actions, and we see, yeah, there is change. There is transformation. So thank you, Ed. All right, I saw a chat come in. Let me address that and we'll get to you, Iris. Okay, so great guidance for observing one's attachment to old ways. Look at the raft and carrying it after crossing the river. Yes, yeah, I think that's such a strong message in these pictures, because, you know, I think many of us, you know, including myself, at some point in our practice thought, you know, I get to number six, riding the ox home, I'm good. That's all I need to do. That's all I wanted to do. And yet we don't realize we carry that in a subtle way, carrying that raft, carrying that, it's really that identification that we formed the sense of me around the meditator. And that's where that, again, that sincerity or that liberation, I'm talking about it like almost like, you know, it's an act of will, which in some ways it is, that surrendering. But also at some point, it's something else starts to pull us forward. We start to realize, well, the more I look at myself, the less I see solidity, the less I see something substantial. And then we start to become more and more clear, greater than that seeing, we become more discerning at when I'm selfing, even that subtle identification around me as the meditator, me as the practitioner. And we realize that going to that place where I feel unformed, I feel, you know, less grounded in a way, because I don't have my normal stability of my conditioning to hold on to. We start to see that itself starts to fall away. And I think that's, you know, Zen, I think, has such a powerful way of pointing toward that, to kind of taking that rug out from under your feet. So thank you, Ellie. Anything else about that, Ellie? Was that? All right, so Iris, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to in part echo Ed's comments about the non-linear way of understanding these, and also the word mastery is, you know, is just, it doesn't work for me, you know, but, you know, I get it, you know. I mean, I have seconds of being at that place, unfortunately, only seconds at a time, whether it's informal practice of being really quiet, minimal thought, and just before I'm, you know, as I'm at that place, just before I realize that, oh, I want more of this, right before then, you know, I you know, there's like these seconds of what I think you're calling mastery, but, you know, it's so it's so fleeting. And but, you know, aside from that, the, you know, the sort of gathering insights into how identification causes suffering, and that kind of understanding and releasing of that is so helpful to decrease suffering. But just really wanting to reaffirm that idea of the non-linear aspect of our of the path, and at least my practice.
Yes. Yeah, it's this. The non-linear aspect is, I mean, it's the reality of our practice, is that, you know, we go this way and that way. And, you know, that sense of mastery. So again, that's kind of just the word that came up around it. You know, it's not, I mean, if you look at those number 5 and 6, taming the ox and riding the ox home, there's a way that the technique, you know, the technique of practice, you know, whatever it might be, it's, you know, there's a level, it's worked. It's like you feel like you've unified, things are connected. And so when there's not, that's feels like that's a struggle, that's hard to feel very stable, that's also a good thing to kind of to wonder about. And sometimes it's how we're approaching it is really the key thing. Because sometimes we can have, you know, a very technically based practice, and that works for our minds, that, you know, I can just give me the 5 steps and I'll just do it till I can do it really well. But sometimes it's much more the insights. And that goes back to that nonlinear process, is that the insights, in my own experience, that's what really transforms your practice. Because other, you know, it's otherwise it's always, you know, me trying to do it. You know, Ellie did a follow-up question, is like how it is with ego. It's like that ego of wanting to, you know, be a good meditator, and also the ego of feeling like I'm not a good meditator. You know, those are both those perspectives. And so this is where sometimes the insight arises, that we start to realize, okay, that ego that everything seems to revolve around, I start to see there's a level of emptiness to it. There's a level of unsubstantiality to it. And then that has an effect of really transforming the very way we're trying to tame the ox, the very way we're trying to meet the ox. In fact, that fifth picture, there's this realization after struggling with the ox and trying to pull it this way and that way, is that, it's the release of that effort. And so that's part of that non-linear process, is that insights then transform the very way we meet our minds, meet this experience. And of course, there's a lot non-linear part that our minds are constantly changing, that each day we wake up a little different. You know, some days we're clear, some days we're just muddled in the mind, and we learn to meet all of that. And that's why it's so beneficial to have that regular practice. Okay, meet my mind today, how it is. I meet this situation, difficult or easy, with as much grace as I can. All right, thank you, Iris. All right, any other questions out there? All right, Allie.
Yeah, hi. This is kind of more of a zooming out, maybe not quite comparative religion question, but you've mentioned a few times, you know, this is from the Zen tradition. And I guess I've sat with some Zen teachers, but not enough to really understand kind of the fundamentally different approaches between Zen and insight meditation, Theravada tradition. So I'm just curious from your perspective, what, you know, how these stories sort of complement maybe some of the ways that you were trained to teach, or some of the resources that we're typically working with in insight meditation, or if that's even a meaningful question. I just I'm curious, because you mentioned, you know, the different approaches sort of build upon one, you know, themselves. So how is this, I don't know, just how do you see this type of storytelling with the pictures complementary or supportive in our tradition?
Sure. Yeah, that's a great question. There's a few elements that you touched upon. So let me see if I can capture those. So one of your questions was around, you know, maybe the most specific part of your question is, how do these series of images, you know, how do they complement our insight practice or our Vipassana practice? And there's also a bigger question of the different approaches. And, you know, again, it's hard to, you know, speak to every tradition all at once. So I'll just kind of do, you know, apologies for my limitations around understanding, because I have not practiced in every manifestation of both Theravadin and Zen. But my overall impression is that Theravadin practice, you know, at least especially the way we tend to practice it, tends to be very clear. You know, there's a sense of, you know, this is how we lay out the instructions. There's a level of, you know, we go through the different Buddhist lists, and there's a level of clarity that we start to grow as practitioners. And then Zen, for example, tends to be a little more dramatic, a little bit more pointing toward the end, like right from the beginnings. Like there's a sense of kind of cutting through our delusion, seeing things very, very clearly and directly, even saying things in a way that's paradoxical, like the koan practice, is that you see a question that is, or a koan, a riddle that is incomprehensible from the rational mind, from the ego mind. The way to find through it is to be able to release that, to shift perspectives, to see where is this makes sense, where does this actually come true, and that's a deep release. One teacher talked about it, the difference between the two traditions generally, was that after a good insight meditation teacher talk, everything's really clear. At the end of a good Zen talk, you're completely confused. And so I think that's one way to approach it, is that there's a greater tolerance or even encouragement for these kind of paradoxical, confusing statements, because it's always, from a Zen tradition, always pointing toward, okay, you know, liberation is right here, even in the midst of this seemingly contradiction. And so in Theravadin, we tend to lay things out in a more clear, systematic way. And that has its benefits. I think it's really helpful for us to find a grounding in the practice and have play. And it also has its limitation that we can tend to be stuck maybe in that, you know, 1 through 6, that level of riding the ox home, that mastery, as I was saying. And we forget that this kind of almost often does feel like a radical release of the ego, radical release of that separation that, you know, Zen points to often right from the beginning. And so I think they both are very complementary to each other, because the Zen, you know, perhaps if it's too direct pointing, as a beginner, we can't really find our ground in it. We can't find our way through it. As a Theravadin person, we can stay too stuck in our patterns, in our techniques, without seeing the, you know, the cutting through of our delusion. And so I think they both can have their benefit. All right, does that help, Allie?
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for the perspective. That's great, thanks.
You're welcome. All right, what else is out there in this Zoom world? All right, Susan.
Let me know if I get staticky or if you can't hear me, Tim, and I'll have to shut off my audio. The other piece that I am very moved and affected by are words, the poetry that is associated with these pictures. And I'm hoping that, you know, in some poetry, you know, one line we can carry with us and have a lot of awareness within that, a lot of heart opening. And you haven't really talked about the poetry in these pictures. Maybe that's next step. That's one thing I think is really going to be different for everyone. And I just want to emphasize that you were speaking about not having a comparing mind and always recognizing what is true for oneself. These are the things that I'm telling myself, what is true for me right now. And the other thing that I know you were talking about faith over practice over faith. And I know there isn't one absolute. I have a feeling I'm going to find a lot of contradictions when we're talking about these, between how Tweri is talking about them, perhaps, and how you're talking about them, because faith is, for me, you know, holds me and keep coming back to this process. And then in another sense, we're not ever arriving. We're always arriving. There's no arrival, because each mind moment is an opportunity for that, you know, freedom or dukkha. So I'm already seeing kind of areas of expression that are a little different, how my mind is holding it right now from, you know, the words you've been using. And when I look at that first picture, for instance, I see this, you know, real innocent longing of not knowing not knowing oneself. And there's a beautiful a beautiful line I heard recently, and that is, it was as if the poem knew me before I knew myself. So sometimes you get that sense in the picture one I'm speaking of, and we often talking about it as that point of confusion and delusion and ignorance. But also for me, there's an innocence there. There's a heart opening, because there is that turning. And so I miss the language that is associated with the pictures. And I guess I want to hear a little more about if that's going to be used and how.
All right. So a couple of points that you put out there. One was around the poetry, you know, the not only the verse around those pictures and how that be used, and, you know, why wasn't that brought up tonight? And also around faith and the relationship to faith. So the first one around the pictures, the phrase or the verses, to be honest, it just felt like it was 10 verses was a lot to try to pack into a one talk. I think the application or the exploration would be much better. Like, okay, let's take this one picture and this one verse and let's really explore that. So it's kind of stepping back a little bit more, just the general sense of each of the pictures, but by no means trying to discount the verse and what the power that takes, because it does speak to us in different ways. Like that line you said, the poet knew me, poem knew me before I knew myself. So sometimes it carries a power to it. And that kind of leads into the second point around faith versus practice. I think, and again, with, you know, Tori and I, we just have different styles of practice, of our own personal practice. And so we both fully support each other, and we're not, you know, trying to be confusing or saying one way is different or better. Just the fact is that there is different ways of approaching. But I would say that the way I approach faith is, I meant that, like, some, I've been talking to some people, just acquaintances who are very religious in other faiths, and you can tell that their whole religious experience is based on faith, on believing the words of this holy book, for example. And I realized that, you know, from a faith perspective, from Buddhist practice, at least from, I can't say that even Buddhist practice, because there's many very faith-based Buddhists, but to say that it's really a confirmed faith, that we have this, okay, I think I want to practice. That's that faith, that trust, that I'm going to try this. And then, but it's confirmed through our direct experience, that there's that, really that seeing, let me see that for myself. And the faith kind of gives you the energy to look, the energy to see, like with the, you know, the seven factors, with faith being one of the prominent ones, or seven factors, or maybe it's the five faculties, one of the lists. You know, faith is the step that allows us to begin the practice. And it is, you know, it is really confirmed by, oh, I see this right here in my mind. I see this right here in my heart. I see this in my relationship with my loved ones. You know, and so it has this depth of understanding behind it. So that's where I would come from around faith and around, you know, the verses.
Yes, thank you for that. It was more of a comment, I guess. Thank you. Look forward to the words.
Yes, yeah, we definitely will highlight those words quite a bit. You know, and there are different translations. There's different versions of that, so that also may be a little confusing, like, you know, this verse versus that verse. So, you know, we'll try to have different ones to different expressions, so we can get a bigger picture of it. But again, the image, and there's different images too. I mean, I'm looking at a set of images which are different than the video that Tori shared last week, you know, and yet they all convey that, you know, that essence of that.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Susan. All right. Anyone else like to share anything or ask anything? Okay, Kathy.
I've enjoyed the comments back and forth. Can you hear me? I can't hear myself for some reason.
You're a little soft.
Okay.
But I can hear you.
Maybe I can speak up. Is that better?
It's a little better, yes.
Oh, dear. Well, I'll just speak up. So, about faith, I've been interested in hearing the comments back and forth tonight, because I have had it resonates with me, and that I do think about it, because I'm around people with lots of very different views. The faith in the practice is what's sustaining me lately. Even my practice, even as stumbling and disjointed as it often is, if I more often lately, I'm finding some support. But what this new study, I guess it's not so new really, it's new to me, the study seems to point to is that we'll be on our own journeys, each of us. It will be like, and I mean, maybe we are anyway, but it maybe you could comment on that. It just feels more maybe self-directed or something like that.
Sure, yeah. The self-directedness, that part I'm not quite sure what you mean by that, but there is the fact that each person here, you know, on this call has their own way the practice unfolds. You know, and you know, it's to frame it from the perspective of these ox herding pictures, each one of us has a different ox and a different way of taming that ox and a different way of riding that ox home and a different way of releasing that. It's like the different gates of Dharma. And I think that's one of the things that we need to figure out as individuals is what is that Dharma gate? What really brings me alive? And if our practice feels kind of dull and kind of like I'm struggling, it could be that there's a, you know, you're kind of stuck in a gate that's not so open to you, you know, and finding what that gate is. That's why it's so helpful to ask questions, you know, to ask for interviews, a way of connecting and exploring. And that's so much of what, you know, our role as teachers is to help people discover their own Dharma gates, to discover their own ox and how that ox needs to be tamed. Because, you know, some people, the taming of that ox looks very different than other people's. You know, sometimes it's a very strong concentration practice. Other times it's much more of a heart-based practice. And it changes too. It's going to the nonlinear process. It's always kind of changing. And it's true that then that becomes the faith. We have more and more faith in our own practice. And that's what kind of leads us through those difficult times.
Very, very nice. Very helpful, Tim. Thank you. I particularly the idea of each of us discovering our own, me discovering my own Dharma gates. It's very, very helpful, intriguing anyway.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I hope for, you know, for each one of us is to grow this sense of discernment about, okay, how am I practicing and know for myself, does it lead to more suffering or does it lead to releasing that suffering? To understand how can I know for myself? Because we do carry so much doubt. We carry so much uncertainty about ourselves and, you know, are we up for the practice? And, you know, sometimes it really is just that wholehearted commitment, that wholehearted surrendering. But it's often in a different direction than we think it is. And sometimes we just keep beating our heads against the wall, trying to force a square peg into a round hole. And it's maybe just find a round hole for that. All right, before I get carried away with metaphors, thank you, Kathy. All right, anyone else like to, these are all wonderful questions and comments. Because that's really what brings it alive, right? It brings it alive for you in your own practice. And your questions, of course, resonate with other people. They help clarify their own way of seeing, their own way of understanding. Emery from Portland.
That's right. Hello.
Nice to see you. Yes.
Thank you. These are, I love the metaphor. And I love how you pointed out that, you know, the purpose of metaphors is to convey so much so directly and simply and sort of efficiently. Like there's so much contained in even just one of these drawings and poems. And when I look at them as a whole, it's really the last one where I see the world represented, like living in the world and the effect that the world has. Well, maybe in the last one, the world isn't having much an effect anymore on that being. But throughout pictures 1 through 9, I'm not seeing how the world is entering into practice and how relating to the world and maybe before you've completely transcended the self, like how is our environment and our life circumstances affecting the ox and the person who's trying to kind of relate to the ox?
Yeah, that's a great question. I hadn't reflected on that, but I think you really highlighted perhaps a limitation of this whole pathway, that it's kind of like you kind of go off into the woods and you practice by yourself and you go live in a hut by yourself, and then eventually your practice, you know, get to the end state, and then you can go back to your life. And that's kind of the assumption that's coming through this particular way this is presented. And so I think that's one of the maybe our challenges this year, is to learn how to integrate that into our lives, is to see, you know, how can I find the ox in the midst of you know, being a mother, you know, having children, having a work, you know, all these things, relationships, all those things that we struggle with that seem to be not part of this. It's like, you know, we're kind of devoting our whole self to this, you know, and that's certainly one model that some people's lives take, and that can be wonderful. And you know, Sims is one of the foundations of it, is that we can wake up in the midst of our daily lives. And so, yeah, I appreciate you saying that. I hadn't really seen that so clearly as you said it. I think that's a great, you know, observation, and that's something that we'll try to, you know, explore as we go through. Is, you know, and like you said, each of these images, each of these phrases. And I'd recommend, you know, each month we'll just, you know, find a picture and a verse that really resonates, and just look at it in a regular basis, because that's going to slowly over the month time seep in, and there'll be insights that will grow over it. And, you know, the question you pose is one of those, in some ways, is a koan, is, okay, how is this in the midst of, you know, dealing with my teenager? You know, how is this in the midst of dealing with those things that seem completely not represented here? Yeah, and I think there is a way through that. So thank you for voicing that, Emery.
We'll answer it for ourselves together.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we will bring up that those questions and you explore it. That's, you know, this last picture, you know, we've talked about this nonlinear part, but that entering the marketplace, you know, perhaps that's one way we can resolve it, is that each of these stages, we need to bring it to the marketplace and learn how to hold that connection with the ox, how to hold that transcending the ox, even in the midst of the marketplace. And that's the work that we all have in front of us, the practice, and the hopefully the joyful work is seeing how to integrate it, how to make it alive. All right, thank you. And thank you all for your engagement. And I'm looking forward to this year's exploration. So next month, starting on Monday the 7th or so, I'll be taking the first picture, and then we'll go back and forth, Tori and myself, and explore these 10 pictures with you. All right, you're welcome to unmute and say goodbye, and thank you again for your support of Sims and the teachers. Thank you all. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.